This is the Plant Yourself Podcast. I'm Howard Jacobson of PlantYourself.com. Before we get to today's interview, a little housekeeping. First of all, big thanks to the following podcast patrons: Kim Harrison, Lynn McClellan, Anthony Disson, Elizabeth Clifton, Brittany Porter, Amy Good, Jerry LaPlaca, for your generous support this month of the podcast. This is the first recording I'm doing with my new used DBX-286A mic preamp compressor in the recording chain, and hopefully it's improving the audio quality and your listening experience. Anyway, it will as soon as I figure out what all the knobs do. If you get the podcast but not the email newsletter, consider going to plantyourself.com and signing up. It comes to your inbox the day of or the day after I put up a podcast, and I include links to articles, to the show notes, and to my weekly TV show, Triangle Be Well. Plus, my grammar is way better in writing. And now today's show. Irving Kirsch is a Harvard researcher who spent the early part of his career exploring one of the most fascinating, powerful, and unacknowledged aspects of healing, the placebo effect. That is, the phenomenon that if you think you are getting an effective treatment, then your mind will trick your body into getting better. The placebo effect, the fact that it occurs at all, is the reason clinical trials need twice as many human subjects as they would otherwise, because we need to be sure that the drug itself has a positive effect independent of the placebo effect. That is, it's better than a sugar pill and a lie. So while diving into the subtleties and ethical considerations of placebo, Kirsch found what he thought was a perfect condition to study: depression. If placebos work by giving hope, and depression is characterized by hopelessness, he reasoned, then he would probably find a robust placebo effect in the treatment of depression. That's when things started getting crazy. The more Kirsch and his colleagues looked over the published literature, the more it appeared that every single benefit attributed to the blockbuster depression drugs like Prozac could be explained away, in fact, by the placebo effect. But I can't tell the story as well as he can. So without further ado, Irving Kirsch, welcome to the Plant Yourself Podcast.
Thanks.
So I wanted to talk to you about specifically your work around antidepressants, but before that, more broadly, your work with placebos. So it's a really interesting topic in that it's everywhere, but it's kind of the water we swim in medical research. We don't really pay much attention to it. Can you tell me like your background? How did you first become interested in studying placebos?
Well, I got interested in studying placebos back when I was still an undergraduate psychology major. There's something that just fascinated me about the whole idea that you could take something and there's nothing in it, but you believe there was, and something would happen that could sometimes be profound. I've just been interested in the whole idea of people's expectations and beliefs and how that influences their experience, and that's been the focus of my research since I was an undergraduate student.
So for folks who are maybe new to this, can you describe what is the placebo effect and why is it so important?
Sure. Well, placebos have been around in medicine for thousands of years. I guess for most of the history of medicine, it was dominated by the placebo effect until modern times, when people were giving substances that they thought were effective medications that turned out not to be, but yet people seemed to get better anyway. Then when people discovered that indeed it's not the substance and the medication that's making people better, but often it's just the belief of one's getting treatment, they started realizing that they needed to control for that in clinical trials in order to determine whether particular medications or procedures were having a real physically based effect or whether it was a psychologically based effect. And that was done for many, many years. But more recently, people have just gotten interested in trying to understand what is it about this effect, this phenomenon that is helps people to improve, sometimes can make people worse as well, that is based psychologically rather than chemically. And that's what the placebo effect is all about. It's what happens when you think you're getting a treatment, but really there's nothing physical in the treatment that is causing the change. Any change that's happening is psychological.
Mm. So it went from being something that was not really on the radar to kind of a medical nuisance for a long time. It was something you were trying to get rid of to show that your treatment, your drug, your surgery, your procedure was effective. Right.
So that's right. And that's still the most frequent use of placebos, is as a control, as a way of making sure that it's the actual drug or the actual surgical incision that's making a difference. But there's been an increasing tendency of scholars to look at the placebo effect, to try to understand it and to see, well, now we have something that does something. How can we make use of that?
Because I remember when I was in the early 90s, I was very interested in what were called alternative therapies then, and I guess sort of still are, things like homeopathy and prayer that didn't necessarily have any physical explanation for them. And their critics would always say, well, this is just placebo effect. And, you know, that was the phraseology used to dismiss it as not being real.
Problem that I've had in the years of studying it is the word just or merely. It's only the placebo effect. It's just the placebo effect, all of which makes it sound like the placebo effect is not important and is not very large. And one of the things that we have learned is that for certain conditions and under certain circumstances, the placebo effect can be very large and not something to be just dismissed out of hand.
Mm-hmm. So I know you've done a lot of research on sort of what goes into creating a larger placebo effect or a smaller placebo effect, you know, like the type of pill, the color thing. What are the things that you've discovered that are sort of, you know, interesting, surprising, sort of, you know, the kind of cool trivia around placebo that would make someone smile?
Well, you've mentioned a couple of them. One is the color. It turns out that color makes a difference, and blue pills are better at producing calming, sedative effects, and red and white pills are better at producing energizing effects and blocking pain. So that's one thing that's probably unexpected until you read about it. The apparent price of a placebo that costs more seems to be more effective than a placebo that costs less. Brand name, a recognized brand name, gives you a stronger effect than having something be a generic. I suppose the companies that are selling medications that are branded, even when generics are available, know that and are making use of that. They're able to get people to buy a more expensive product when the identical product without the brand name is also available. And people who believe in that brand name are probably getting a better effect from the medication because of the placebo component. The mode of administration makes a difference. Placebo capsules can be better than placebo pills. Placebo injections are better than placebo capsules or pills, and placebo surgery, that's the best placebo of all. There have been studies in which people have been cut open and sewn back up without doing the surgical intervention. It's a control for a surgical procedure to see if it's really the surgery that's making a difference. You've got a whopping placebo effect with that kind of placebo.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that there are sort of, you can have the opposite of a placebo. I guess it's called a nocebo effect, where you can get worse because you believe you should get worse.
Sure, that's sometimes called the placebo's evil twin, and it's not just a question of getting worse. You can get side effects because you believe that there are going to be side effects.
And I remember reading, again, decades ago, like the Serpent and the Rainbow about, you know, Haitian voodoo and various societies in which the medicine man would curse you and then you would dutifully go home and die, right? Or you know, lose a limb or something. And is, you know, how well have those sorts of things sort of outside of our culture been studied in terms of placebo effect? Can things be that stark?
Well, of course, it's very hard to study in a really controlled way. you know, for obvious reasons. There were studies done by an anthropologist by the name of Cannon decades ago on voodoo death. And he also came up with a physiological explanation of how it might occur. People were literally getting scared to death when they were being cursed. And the physiological explanation that was written about more recently and seems to hold as a possibility. But again, it's a difficult thing to study, and I would not have great certainty in it.
So do we know to some extent how placebo works, assuming that there is a physiological bridge between the mind and the workings of our cells?
Well, first let's talk about the subjective effects of placebo. So that's what's strongest. And we shouldn't dismiss it, because medicine has two purposes. One is to extend life, and the other is to alleviate discomfort. So a lot of the things that we are focusing on in medical treatment don't extend life, but alleviate discomfort, diminish pain, for example. And these are subjective effects by definition. And so they're very important. And that's where you see the strongest placebo effects, when you're dealing with subjective phenomena like pain, anxiety, depression, and so on. Now, the thing that's interesting about it, of course, is our consciousness, our experience, is linked to a particular organ in our body, and that's the brain. So whenever there's a change in experience, whether it be a reduction in pain, an alleviation of anxiety, that's also going to be manifested in the brain. And what we have been seeing are neurophysiological studies, brain imaging studies, where we look at the areas of the brain that are affected when you get pain reduction. For example, that's the best study by giving someone a placebo.
Okay. So that something like that, you can just say, well, people will notice certain things and not notice other things. So, if you're distracted, pain is less bad. So that's the whole subjective part, that somehow someone's brain is actively either not necessarily fooling themselves, but simply focusing on something else, and so experiences their life in a better way. But
it's not just distraction. And that's very clear, because in the studies that are done on pain, looking at placebo effects, there's no attempt to distract people from it, just the opposite. People are asked to focus on it so that they can report what's happening to their pain levels, and to pay careful attention to it, and to rate them on an ongoing basis. That's not consistent with distraction. But what we see are changes in the activity in brain areas that are specifically linked to pain. And that tells us it's not just a question of they're turning away from it, but actually that they are experiencing less pain.
Mm-hmm. And what about the non-subjective effects, the things that can be measured, completely independently of perception?
I think most of the physiological effects are tied to perception and to experience. Now, there's some others. You can when you have placebo treatment for asthma, under some conditions, you seem to be able to get physiological changes and in some cases not. And when you're treating Parkinson's disease, it can be a large effect. Placebo effect in the treatment of Parkinson's disease, you also can get it on movement measures. When you're treating things like, there was a major study that was done on osteoarthritis of the knee, placebo surgery for osteoarthritis of the knee, and you get a good size effect on walking and climbing. But I think those are also tied to the perceptual effect, the feeling of less pain.
Gotcha. Which leads to a kind of an ethical quandary or a paradox, where if you're telling people that really it's your mind is doing this stuff, couldn't we just tell people that they could do it without the drug? That, you know, to just teach people to create their own placebo effect in the brain? Does that work at all? Or do we always need a tool, a pill or a procedure or some kind of intervention?
Well, I think that's the next step, is how to harness the placebo effect. There are two approaches to that that are not mutually exclusive that have been pursued and that we are pursuing right now. One is the use of open-label placebo, that is, giving people a placebo and telling them it's a placebo and explaining to them how the placebo works and how they can make use of that. We've done that with irritable bowel syndrome, most notably, investigating other areas as well, and have had very nice success with that. So that's one approach. Another approach is to use procedures like hypnotic suggestion, which is also used in irritable bowel syndrome to good effect, and may be largely based on a placebo effect, but again, without deception, without having to take a pill, knowing exactly what you're doing, and being able to find a way to harness the self-healing capacity of the human brain.
And are those the open-label placebo effects similar in magnitude to the ones when people are being, quote, deceived?
Well, that's an interesting question. We haven't made direct comparisons. From what I can see, indirectly, the effect is quite high. We seem to be getting stronger effects with open-label placebo than you typically get with double-blind placebo, which is how things are done in clinical trials, where you tell people you may be getting a placebo, you may not. We seem to be able to get better effects telling people this is a placebo and explaining to them how and why it might work, even though they know it's a placebo.
It's interesting because as I'm thinking about it, it almost reminds me of sort of like a religion where if the entire culture all believes something, then it's a very it can have a much more powerful effect than if just an individual believes it or suspects it. And, you know, in traditional societies with the shaman or the medicine man, everyone shared a belief, a basic cosmology. In our society, the only thing we all really believe in, push comes to shove, is medical science. And so I'm wondering how we can move beyond that into saying, well, the brain has its own innate healing capacity that Western science really hasn't honored very much.
Well, I don't think we have to move away from Western medical science in order to do that. Instead, I think what we can be doing and are doing is incorporating understanding of the placebo effect in studies and scientific studies of the placebo effect, incorporating that into medical science.
So sort of marketing it to the general public so it becomes an accepted treatment modality.
Well, first of all, understanding it and understanding how physicians and healers of various kinds, health workers of various kinds, can make use of it without deception.
Mm-hmm.
One thing we're learning, for example, and that has been studied, I think people are very open to it, accepting now, increasingly so, is the importance of the clinician patient relationship in producing positive outcomes across a variety of disorders. So that's part of the placebo effect. That's part of the things you want to control for when you're studying the effect of a medication. So that's part of the placebo effect. And there's a placebo component within any bona fide medical treatment. If it's for a disorder that's amenable to a placebo effect, if you boost that component, you're likely to boost the response to the active treatment. And one way of doing that is by enhancing the doctor-patient relationship, having a clinician who is spending time with the patient, who's listening, who's empathetic and has the time to engage with the patient and form an alliance, that kind of clinician-patient relationship is likely to produce better outcomes than a rushed, hurried physician that doesn't have the time to engage with the patient.
Mm. Boy, wouldn't that be amazing if that became part of best practices, that you could get brought before the HMO board if you were spending less time, because that was going to lead to clinically worse outcomes.
That's right.
Mm. What about, so I can see, there's no downside to having a good relationship, but what about, let's say, there's a doctor who has a patient who, and you're giving them some drug that from clinical trials has maybe a 3% chance of working. Would you tell them that? Or would it, it's such an ethical quandary. Like, if you could tell them the data, as opposed to, I'm certain this will work for you, or you're the sort of person who can get great results from this. Do you know what I'm asking? Like, either way, if you tell the stark truth, or you build it up, maybe in not in accordance with the data, which one is the worst sin, or which one is the best way to do no harm and to do help?
Well, I don't believe in deceiving patients. I think honesty is important. I think autonomy is an important ethical principle that needs to be respected. I think people need to be honest. Now, I think there should be, it makes sense to encourage positive expectations, but realistically positive expectations, and ones that are not counter to the data.
Mm-hmm. Okay, because I recently interviewed Dr. Kelly Turner, who's written a book called Radical Remission, sort of people making these miraculous, according to Western medicine, recoveries from cancer that was deemed like, there's nothing more we can do for you. And so I would, in a sense, I'd want to include that data, but it's kind of hard to know how to do that when you have, the labels, the packet inserts from the drugs, and yet that there's this outlier possibility that something amazing could happen.
I think one can discuss outlier possibilities and honestly let people know, look, there are cases of what appear to be spontaneous remission that one would never suspect. And the literature has written that up. There may be some of that may be due to various factors, but to honestly present what we know so that patients can make an informed choice and an informed decision.
Gotcha. Okay, so let's move into the other thing that I wanted to talk to you about, and how your work came onto my radar, which was at a certain point you were looking for really likely places for the placebo effect to be large and noticeable, and you mentioned that you couldn't find it at all with infections and antibiotics. There just didn't seem to be any, and it was fairly large with pain, and so you and some colleagues thought that depression would be a great place to study placebo. What made you think that?
Well, one of the central features of depression is a sense of hopelessness. And sometimes what people are hopeless about is their own condition of being depressed. They feel like this is the worst thing in my life, this depression that I'm experiencing, and I've gotten hopeless about ever getting out of it, getting better again. And that, of course, is going to increase my depression. And so I've got this negative cycle going. So one of the things that the promise of a possibly effective treatment, a new treatment might do, would be to counter that sense of hopelessness, to provide a sense of hope that maybe there is a possibility, maybe I can get better. And that's particularly important with depression, given that hopelessness is a central feature of depression. So it makes sense to me on that basis that anything that would instill a sense of hope for a depressed person about their own depression would lead to some beneficial change. And so I thought, when I started this, I assumed that antidepressant drugs were effective, but I figured that in addition to the drug having an effect, there should also be a good-sized placebo effect, and that led me to start evaluating that.
Okay. And what was the first sense that you had that the drugs weren't as effective as the pharmaceutical industry was promoting them as?
It came from studying those data. What we were interested in was comparing what happens on placebo treatment compared to what happens if you don't get the placebo, if you don't get any treatment at all. And the only place that we could find data on depressed patients being given placebos was in the drug trials. So that's where we got those data. But that meant we also had the data on the drug, and so we looked at that as well. And I was initially quite surprised to see how small the drug placebo difference was for something that had been heralded as constituting a revolution in the treatment of depression. And that began to shift the focus of some of my research to looking at the drug placebo difference in depression, how much of what was happening when you gave somebody an antidepressant, how much of that was a placebo effect and how much was a drug effect. And did some subsequent meta-analyses after that and found that the largest component of the response was being duplicated by placebo. That is, you would get almost as much better if you had a placebo pill than if you took an antidepressant, with the difference between the response to the placebo and the response to the antidepressant being minuscule, not being clinically meaningful at all.
Right. Now, you first published this, I think, in the mid-90s, when meta-analyses themselves were a fairly new and controversial way of looking at data. And, you know, you write that your study was published with basically a cigarette warning around it, saying that this is dangerous stuff. We think it might be interesting and of value, but, like, really warning people about how controversial this concept was.
The concept of meta-analysis, of course, that's no longer true. Meta-analysis is now accepted. It's no longer controversial. It becomes the best tool that we have and most commonly used tool for evaluating the effectiveness of something against the placebo or for any decision based on a large number of studies. It's the way we pool studies together to understand what are we learning if we take all the studies, put them together, and see what they're finding.
So, but even at that point, you know, it wasn't just the fact of the meta-analysis, it was what you found. There were objections coming out of the woodwork from every possible angle, trying to discredit the work, trying to show that you hadn't seen what you had seen. So one of these was around which studies you chose to include, right? So can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, people said, how could you find something like that? We know antidepressants work. If you found such a small difference, you must have been looking at the wrong studies. So what we did next was to replicate our own study with a whole different set of clinical trials, and we went to what should be the definitive database. We used the Freedom of Information Act. We went to the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, and obtained from them data on the clinical trials that had been submitted to them by the drug companies in the process of getting approval for what at that time were the six most widely used antidepressant drugs. And that turned out to be very important because it turned out that 4 out of 10 of the clinical trials sponsored by the drug companies had never been published. They were unknown. The data was not available other than, at that time, using the Freedom of Information Act and going to the FDA to get them. And you won't be surprised to learn that the trials that were not published were those that showed the least benefit for the drug. So by going to the FDA, we now had data from not only the published trials, but also the unpublished trials. We had the data from all of the trials that the FDA had deemed to be adequate and well-controlled trials. And we were able to put them together and see what the effect was. And what we found was that the difference between drug and placebo was even smaller than we had found just looking at published literature.
Okay. So a brief detour there about how the FDA works. They get the pharmaceutical companies have to give them all their data. They don't have to publish all of the data, but how does the FDA determine whether to give a new drug approval? You know, if 40% of the trials show no effect or almost no effect or maybe even a negative effect compared to placebo, do they have to consider that? Or like how do they make that decision?
Their rule is that there has to be two clinical trials showing a statistically significant difference between drug and placebo. Now, there are two catches to that. One catch is there's no limit on how many trials you can run in order to get the two positive trials. So you might run seven trials and find two that are positive, and then you submit that to the FDA, and the FDA will approve it, even though five of the trials did not show positive results. So that's one thing. The second catch is that it doesn't matter how large the difference is. It has to be statistically significant. If you have enough subjects in a trial, you can get a statistically significant difference with a very small effect. And the fact that it's a small effect that wouldn't make any real difference in a person's life, that's not part of what is looked at by the FDA in approving antidepressants. When you read the minutes of their meetings, it's clear that they talk about this issue, but say, you know, that our rules are, it just has to be statistically significant. It may be a small effect, and it may be that it's only turned up in two out of seven or eight or nine trials, but those are our rules.
So you're saying that if, like, I'm a terrible basketball player, but if I wanted to make a highlight reel and I just shot three-pointers, like, all day, and I made two of them, I could submit that to the Knicks or the Celtics, and they would just have to consider those in determining my, like, is that, that's...
Well, I have to confess I don't know a lot about basketball, but that sounds like an appropriate analogy to me. Here's the words that I saw in the minutes of some FDA deliberations that led to approval of one of the antidepressants. Well, gee, they could just do studies till the cows come home, until they find the two that get them significant results.
Is there any movement in medical or scientific or academic circles to change that? Because it sounds crazy. It sounds like as long as you have enough money, you can get anything approved.
I don't see any movement. The one thing that I see is a movement towards greater transparency, towards making all the data available. And there's a campaign, and it's called All Trials campaign, that is attempting to get regulations internationally which would mandate pharmaceutical companies to make available all of the data of all the trials they conduct. And I think that's an important movement.
Hmm. Now, you also talked about the idea of the difference between statistical significance and clinical significance. In other words, is it a difference that makes a difference? You found that the difference between placebo and the antidepressant drugs was pretty minimal on this Hamilton scale of depression, right?
That's right. In fact, it's so small that if a patient were to improve by that amount, a treating clinician would rate that as no change at all.
So for an individual, it's a meaningless difference, and it's only significant statistically because there were so many thousands of people in these trials.
Yeah, it's not in thousands. It's typically smaller, much smaller than that, but trials are large enough so that a relatively small effect can give you a statistically significant difference. Let me give you an example for that. Imagine that a study has been done on 500,000 people. I'm going to give you an extreme example, and has found that smiling increases life expectancy by 10 seconds. Now, who cares about the 10 seconds? But with that many subjects, with that large a trial, a 10 seconds difference is almost certain to be statistically significant, even though it's clinically meaningless.
And so that difference in the Hamilton D scores, I think it was like 1.8% with some data set, or 1.8 points.
Yeah, our data being controversial has been, our meta-analyses have been replicated over and over again now, some by critics, some by people who weren't necessarily critics, using the same data set we had, using a larger data set. I've seen one meta-analysis that was able to get all of the data from all the trials ever done by the ever sent to the FDA, and all the drugs, all the antidepressant drugs that was done in-house in the FDA, and everybody gets basically the same results, about a 2-point difference between drug and placebo.
Okay. Now, one of the ways the industry, now obviously the pharmaceutical industry that makes these antidepressants and the psychiatric profession that prescribes them didn't really like your conclusions, and especially because since they knew that antidepressants worked, they were trying to figure out all the ways in which you could have possibly gotten it wrong. One of the things they kept saying was that you're looking at the wrong types of patients. So is there a difference in the effect, in the placebo effect, in the drug effect, in mild or moderate or severe depression?
Well, we actually did look at that in our meta-analysis that we published in 2008. We looked at people who were moderately depressed and people who were very severely depressed. We found that severity does make a difference. So the more severely depressed the person is, the greater the drug placebo difference, but it's always very small, even for the very severely depressed patients. And for most of the very severely depressed patients, it's not clinically meaningful at all. For the mild and moderately depressed patients, it seems to be zero difference between drug and placebo.
Right. And you write that the difference in the severe depressed population is that the placebo is working less well, not that the drug is working better. How does that work?
Well, one of the things we think it might be due to is people breaking blind. People that are on the antidepressant drugs are more likely to experience side effects. Based on that, they are likely to know, oh, I'm not in the placebo group. I'm in the antidepressant group. And that way, since they have more confidence that they're getting a real treatment, they will show a larger drug effect. And we know that from studies. We know that when you do trials that are open label, where there is no placebo condition, or they might be comparing just two active antidepressants, and again, no placebo condition, and people know that they are getting an active antidepressant, you get a better response to the drug than in trials with the same drug when people are thinking, oh, well, this is placebo controlled, so I might be getting a placebo. So people might be breaking blind. There are two studies that have been done looking at people who have been on antidepressants before and now going to a clinical trial, and people who haven't been on antidepressants before. Those who haven't been on antidepressants before, there's absolutely zero difference between the drug and the placebo. You only see a difference in people who've been on the antidepressants before. Those are the people who are likely to know what the side effects are, and when they don't get those side effects, they are likely to conclude, I must be on the placebo.
Mm-hmm. So this concept of breaking blind is so interesting, and I really hadn't considered it before from the perspective of the participant in the trial. But the way you describe it, that person is desperate to figure out, or is desperately wondering, am I going to get better or not? Am I in the real group or the placebo group? So how does breaking blind work, and what does side effects have to do with whether someone breaks blind or not?
Okay, I don't know whether they're desperate, and it's not just the patient that breaks blind, it's also the physician, the clinician who may be doing the ratings on how much better a person has gotten. But people wonder, if you were in a clinical trial and you knew you might be getting a placebo, you might be getting an active drug, wouldn't you wonder which group am I in? I would certainly wonder. Now, when you go into a clinical trial, you have to be given a chance to, you have to give informed consent. That means that the experimenters have to tell you about what they're going to do, and then you have to agree based on that information to be in the trial. And one of the things they tell you is that it's double blind, that you may be getting a placebo, and another thing that they tell you is that the real drug may produce side effects, and they tell you exactly what side effects have been reported for that drug. So if you then go into the clinical trial and you experience the side effects that you were told the drug produces, you're likely to break blind, conclude that, oh, I'm in the real drug condition. Whereas if you're in the placebo condition, you won't experience those side effects, and you won't be making the conclusion that, oh, I must be in the real drug condition.
Now, so, and your hypothesis, because you did discover that there was no clinical difference between the drugs and placebos, and there was a tiny statistical difference sometimes, but it was always in favor of the drugs. So the placebo, the drugs are definitely a teeny weeny bit better than the placebos. But you say that your hypothesis is that that's due to the side effects of the drugs, that it's what you call like a super strength placebo instead of a regular strength placebo.
I think that's one possibility, and there are a lot of data suggests that is indeed what's going on. Now, maybe there is a very tiny real drug difference at all that would have respect some other reason. The important point at this point is that if there is any drug effect at all, it's very small. It's not enough to be clinically meaningful to a patient in their life, and it's obtainable by various other forms of treatment, and that's important because these are potent drugs. They are potent medications. They produce side effects. They have health risks. It's just that chemically they do not do much for depression.
Well, and you said that there were studies of not just the older antidepressant drugs, the tricyclics and the newer ones, the SSRIs, the Prozacs, but there were trials that showed barbiturates, sedatives, and synthetic thyroid hormone also as good as the antidepressants and slightly better than the placebos. Like, how is that possible?
That's true.
How is that possible?
Again, the breaking blind hypothesis would support that, but the one thing all these drugs have common is that they produce side effects that people are going to notice and may break blind and lead them to have a stronger placebo effect.
So one of the reverse engineering aspects of your research is that everybody knows that depression is a problem with brain chemistry, some sort of brain imbalance, some sort of deficiency, which is not just true of depression, but also anxiety, schizophrenia. These are all brain-based chemical disorders, but we know this because the drugs that we've created for them seem to work. So doesn't that kind of call into question this whole hypothesis that it's a serotonin or a dopamine or a chemical imbalance?
Sure, I'm going to confine my comments on that to the area of depression, which I studied most closely, although I can say with confidence that antidepressants are as ineffective in the treatment of anxiety as they are in the treatment of depression. But you're absolutely right that the way in which this chemical imbalance hypothesis came about was having drugs usually done early on without controlled trials, as if they didn't do placebo controls because they hadn't yet realized how powerful the placebo could be. And they said, oh, look, these drugs seem to work. They seem to make people less depressed. Let's see what those drugs do chemically. That must be the cause of depression. The reasoning is really a little bit silly. It's like deciding, oh, look, morphine blocks pain. pain, therefore, must be due to a deficiency of morphine.
That's a great analogy. So then what do we have any better sense of the etiology of depression based on the fact that placebo seems to be so powerful in ameliorating it?
So I don't want to make the same mistake that the drug advocates made in coming up with causality of depression based on what treatment works. What we do know about depression is that it's usually linked to some kind of negative event or events in one's life, very often a significant loss, a loss of a loved one, a loss of a job. Things like that can produce depression in the way in which one thinks about and interprets and what it does to one's sense of hopefulness and about the future. Lead to someone being depressed for a longer period of time. But very often, depression is very often a normal reaction to a terrible state of affairs. We don't have to pathologize misery.
So I was shortly after I watched your course on Rizuku, I happened to find myself at a dinner across the table from someone who said that she was a psychiatrist. So I had to sort of remember my table manners and not get too feisty, but I was very curious because I had, you know, your lecture was in my head, very much front and center. And I kind of asked her, like, you know, how she dealt with depression and what did she think of some of these studies? And she said, oh, absolutely. We know that the SSRIs are placebo. That's why I give them, because it would be unethical to give actual placebos. And I want people to get better so that they start going to therapy. And I was curious about your thoughts on that, that, you know, again, you know, coming back to this ethics question, we don't want to deceive people, but giving, you know, it seemed to me to be crazy to give people these psychoactive drugs with all these known side effects because they're placebos. What's your thoughts about that?
Well, again, I don't believe that patients should be deceived. And what's very important in this area is that there are so many treatments that in the short run work as well as antidepressants. And that includes physical exercise programs, psychotherapy, and a whole gamut of psychotherapies for that matter. Acupuncture shows data that's very similar to that of antidepressants. And head-to-head comparisons, there's no difference between acupuncture and SSRIs. So there are all kinds of alternatives that don't carry the risks that antidepressants carry. And there's some evidence that both psychotherapy and physical exercise can lead to better long-term outcomes. That is, patients who get better are much less likely to relapse if treated through psychotherapy or physical exercise than if they've taken a drug. There's even a possibility from the data that antidepressant drugs may increase the risk of relapse, even compared to placebo treatments. So I would never advocate giving an antidepressant to someone in order to get the placebo effect. If you're going to go for the placebo effect, use something less dangerous.
So is there a situation in which you would think that the SSRIs or the tricyclics would still be appropriate, or you think they should just be relegated to kind of the dustbin of medical history, like you know, routine bloodletting and trepanning and other things that we now see as just nuts?
Well, I have to tell you that my thinking on that has been gradually changing over the years. And I at first thought, well, these were at least partially effective drugs and could be given to help the acutely get over the depression, and then the data convinced me that that was not the case. And then I used to say, up until very recently, antidepressants should be given as a last resort, never as a first-line treatment, but a last resort when people fail to respond to other treatments. Now, looking at more of the data, I'm skeptical even of that, to the point where I would say that I don't think antidepressants should be given to anyone who's not taken them before. There's no evidence that they will do any good at all for someone who's not taken them before. There is evidence that they will do harm, including long-term risk of being depressed.
That's pretty stark, especially, you know, so many of the statements I've made, you've kind of qualified, and I know, you know, from reading your research that you're very, very cautious in making sweeping statements. So that's your research is clearly presented an argument that I find very hard for anyone to refute who doesn't have a lot of skin or money in the game of selling these drugs.
Thank you. But I will note one qualification that was in that last statement. I was talking about people who have never been on antidepressants before. It's a very, much more difficult dilemma that one faces with people who've been on the antidepressants before. Part of it may be due to the effect of withdrawal that one gets when they're taken off of antidepressants. They work in some ways like addictive drugs for many people. And if you have someone that has gotten relief on antidepressants and has been on it before and may be more prone to relapse because they've been on it before, that's a more difficult situation. And I'm not sure what I would suggest for that. But for someone who has never been on an antidepressant, beginning to take one is the worst approach to dealing with depression.
Gotcha. So what research are you doing now? What questions linger or new avenues of curiosity and wonder for you?
Well, my colleagues and I are continuing to explore what we call open-label placebos, honest placebos, placebos given honestly and non-deceptively. We're looking at that in a number of different disorders. We have looked at that in irritable bowel syndrome. We're working on a study to replicate that and compare it to what seems to be the most potent medication that has been used for irritable bowel syndrome. We're looking at it in chronic low back pain. There's been a feasibility study looking at it in depression, and we're trying to see if we can extend that into a full-scale clinical trial. So that's one of the areas that we're going into at this point.
Mm-hmm. And has all your professional work with placebos changed the way you deal personally with your own health and with decisions about treatment?
Well, that's a good question. I certainly, my research over the last 15 years or so on looking at antidepressants and things that I would have never suspected before looking into the literature certainly does get me to be more cautious in medications that I am prescribed. And sometimes I will want to look at the data and check out the clinical trials that have been done for myself. And so I am more cautious than I have been in the past.
And have you ever tried to sort of harness your own placebo effect, to enhance it or to kind of look at how mind can make us well?
I certainly make use of techniques that are used in cognitive behavior therapies and dealing with my own issues in life.
Gotcha. Well, so Dr. Irving Kirsch, I'm so grateful for your work. When I first saw it and then reading, and I should mention that you have a fascinating book, The Emperor's New Drugs, Exploding the Antidepressant Myth. I guess it's now 6 years old or 7 years old. And it's, first of all, it's such a breezy read. I'm always worried when I start picking up a medicine or science book that's going to be kind of very, very dense. But this was so conversational and logical and written both for the scientific community and the layperson. And just the curiosity and integrity of your approach just shines through. And I'm so grateful for your work, and I'm so grateful for the chance to explore it with you today.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for mentioning the book, and it's been a pleasure to chat with you about this today.
All right. Well, continue going from strength to strength. I will follow your research, and be well.
Thanks. You too.
Bye-bye.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Plant Yourself Podcast. If you're new to the show, you can catch up on over 140 archived episodes over at plantyourself.com. If you'd like to support the show, you can do so in three main ways. You can share this and other episodes on social media or via email with anyone you think would enjoy or benefit from the conversations. You can write a review on Stitcher or iTunes, and you can become a patron by pledging either an ongoing donation or a one-time amount to the podcast over at plantyourself.com, over on the right sidebar. And the more regular monthly income I can count on from the podcast, the better I can make it. You know, even labors of love have expenses, and this one is expanding to take up more and more of my time and energy. And that's wonderful, but even a dollar a month means a lot in terms of feedback that this work is appreciated and valued. I have an announcement. I have a new course online that you can take. It's called the Proteinaholic Transition Course, named after the book Proteinaholic that I wrote with Dr. Garth Davis. And the course is essentially a video-based online course designed to help you transition easily and deliciously to a plant-powered diet. Right now I'm doing what I call a soft launch to work out any remaining bugs. So I'm looking for super motivated folks who would like to transition to a plant-powered diet but haven't cracked the code yet. Maybe you're not sure what to cook, or how to find the time, or how to afford it, or how to deal with family or friends or social pressure, or how to deal with cravings, or whatever. Whatever's holding you back, this course is designed to bring you through all of that. And here's how super motivated you have to be to give it a try now. You have to remember this URL, proteinaholic.com/well. That's W-E-L-L. The first series of videos is on mindset, and it's in front of the paywall, so those are publicly available. There's about 13 of them, I think. The next six series of videos, about 80 or in total, are behind the paywall, which is configured as pay what you can. So you can pay the recommended amount, which is $99, which is a little over a dollar a video, or you can pay more, or you can pay less, or you can even pay nothing at all. And that may change, but for now, that's how it is. So if you want to get in on the ground floor, have a lot of my attention, and give me feedback on what's working and what still needs work, that webpage, once again, is proteinaholic.com/well. In garden news, two things. One, the chickens have started laying like crazy all of a sudden. I'm not sure what other chicken sanctuaries do with their eggs, but we're giving some to our neighbors in compensation for all the times the chickens sneak into their yards and eat their birdseed. We're growing seedlings indoors now, and now we're putting them under cheap fluorescent lights that I got at Lowe's for like $20 for 2 4-foot fluorescent light bulbs. And we save hundreds of dollars by not getting the recommended full-spectrum natural daylight specialty lighting from the gardening catalogs. And it occurred to me that sometimes settling for good enough is a very good idea. So here's my question. Where are you waiting to take action until everything is perfect? Is there an imperfect action you can take right now just to get things into motion? That's it for this week. And as always, be well, my friends.